You're listening to The Local Maximum, episode 231.
Time to expand your perspective. Welcome to The Local Maximum. Now, here's your host, Max Sklar.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. You have reached another Local Maximum. I am currently, as I'm recording this, I'm currently staying in Raleigh, North Carolina for a wedding. When this goes out, I will be back home. But yes, I was in a wedding party this weekend with Aaron for our mutual friend Craig and Suzanne. Craig, who was the groom, and he's been on the show, actually. Craig's been on the show, episode 95 specifically. I think he's been on the show multiple times, but that was the big one. That was the episode where we did inspiration from gaming, product inspiration from gaming, and I talked to Craig, and I talked to Dennis Crowley, so I'll definitely link to that. Wedding was amazing, but some crazy things happened. You know, there was a big storm, and the power was out for the entire reception. Now, fortunately, the food was already cooked, and the DJ and everyone had kind of a backup power generator. I don't know how they did that. The venue did not. So it was, but it wasn't dark yet, you know, because it gets light late here. So the show went on and everything went pretty well, I think. But that was kind of a unique situation, a very interesting thing that happened this weekend. And I think everyone had a good time. I mean, I don't know, you know, it's a wedding. I don't know what kind of drama happened behind my back. But no, it was a good time was had by all, as far as I'm concerned. Next week, so as you know, I'm once again talking to you from the road multiple times this month, and that makes this show kind of difficult, but the show will go on. Next week, I am traveling once again to Porkfest. That's up north in Lancaster, New Hampshire. That's the Liberty Conference up there. It's, again, all outdoors. I'm giving a couple of talks. I'm actually sponsoring the Local Maximum on the Local Maximum is a sponsor for Porkfest, which means that, you know, the logo will be on the main stage. We'll see how that goes, whether that was a good idea or not. I think it'll be a lot of fun. It was a good idea. It wasn't too expensive. You know, maybe I should actually sponsor some tech conferences as well. And so I'm giving two talks. I'm giving like Intro to Liberty 101 on inflation, which I am now. I'm like, I can't believe I got roped into this, because now I have to look up like what is inflation, and apparently it's a lot more difficult than I thought it was. But I think I'm going to be able to put something good together. And then the last day, Friday, I'm going to give a talk that will not be recorded, because I want to be able to say stuff that I can't quite say on the podcast about you know, how crazy it's getting politically at work. I know I've said a few things in the podcast, but I can be more specific when I'm not being recorded. So if you want to come to that, let me know, because I do have some extra tickets. So localmaxradio@gmail.com, or just come to the locals, maximum.locals.com for tickets. Obviously, people on the locals will get priority. But yeah, I'm looking forward to that, and looking forward to both those talks, even though that's a lot of talks to give. I used to think it was a very glamorous lifestyle going around the country, giving speeches and stuff. But all this prep, it's a lot of work, this prep. No, it's still kind of a lot of fun. So I know we have to talk about the crypto markets as well. They just, as someone I know would say, they just took a huge dump, another huge dump. Now, for me, it's like, you know, we've been here before, for sure. And there's all this crazy talk on Reddit and Twitter. And when crypto was up, people were saying, oh, it's always going to go up. It's way higher than you think it is. And then when it's down, people are like, it's going to go way lower than you think it is. Usually, neither are true. And I think we've been here before several times since I've gotten in. But even while I've been doing the podcast, we've been in, I think we were in this cycle. This is about where we were in the Bitcoin cycle when we were around November 2018. So I kind of want to go back and see what I was saying around November 2018 and relate it to our day. But we could talk about this a bit more at some point. I don't really have everything together today. And also, let's see like where this all shakes out. The crypto markets always choose to go nuts when I am away, and it's very difficult for me to, like, you know, be on top of the markets and stuff. I remember very distinctly when I think it was when the DAO, the original DAO, the Ethereum based decentralized autonomous organization, when that kind of blew up and became Ethereum Classic, and Ethereum split apart, and it was kind of dropping precipitously, and everyone was like, Ethereum is dying. Of course, that wasn't true. I was in Africa. I was in Ghana, Africa, barely had internet. I had enough internet to check the prices. The price could come in. Images were not coming in too well into my phone, but the price information, that's only a few bits, so that was coming in. Maybe I got a few emails here and there, but it's like, yeah, there's nothing I could do about this when I'm in Africa, and I feel the same way. I mean, I know it's, I know they have internet in North Carolina, but I'm away from all my, all my devices. I'm doing things all day, you know, which is probably good. It's probably a good thing to kind of be away from the markets when everything's crashing and be able to relax a little bit. So we can talk about and you know, I think it's these markets. You got to think long term about these markets, and I'm very excited about crypto and specifically Bitcoin and Ethereum in the long term. I think Bitcoin and Ethereum have kind of different use cases, and both can coexist. And we've talked about Bitcoin on the show. We've talked about Ethereum on the show. We haven't really done a comparison. So that would be an interesting thing to do at some point in the future. But yeah, let's see where this all shakes out, and we'll talk about what happened in the crypto markets. Obviously, when there's a down market, it's helpful to look at some of the individual decisions and situations that have caused companies to go bust, because that could help, you know, prevent the same mistake, and it could kind of help figure out, well, who's doing things right. And all that. So that's great. Obviously, you know, the ones that come to mind are Celsius and what's that one called? 3AC. I actually hadn't heard of it before today. So yeah, I definitely have not done enough research to talk about it with you, but it's something I'm interested in. So what are we doing today? Today's episode, we're going to talk about AI research, but I realize it's going to get a little technical, whereas I think we all want to know, like, what's AI going to be able to do in the future? We all want to see our self-driving car. By the way, I was in a Tesla recently that does almost self-driving, that has some self-driving features, and boy, is it trippy. Like, you could be in one end of the parking lot and call it, and it just comes to you with no driver, and I'm like, what if someone looks over and sees it? So that is really trippy. Are we going to have robots cleaning my house? Am I going to have a digital assistant that's actually not an idiot? It's really that voice that you can talk to and is super smart and can understand you and solve your problems. That's the level that we're after when we talk about artificial general intelligence. And so I kind of think AI researchers all think they're building towards this general intelligence, but what applications, what advances do they come up with along the way that end up leading to products that affect our lives? That's often a big question. So you have these large language models that are all the rage these days. You know, we've talked about GPT-3 on the program. We've talked about Lambda on the program last week, and that's where these large language models purport to be building. They purport to be shooting after that general AI, this friend, not necessarily a friend, but something that you can talk to and has kind of a high level of understanding of what you're saying. And last week, we went over the thing that happened at Google, where an employee was put on leave after claiming that their chatbot Lambda is sentient. One thing that I did not go over last week, and I'm glad I didn't go over because it's a very deep, very difficult question, is how would we know if a machine is actually sentient? How can we determine that? I can't answer that today, but I think it's a very deep question, and I think I would go to an even more fundamental question, which is, do we have any tools at all to be able to answer this question? And so I'm going to try to figure out if we do, because I'm kind of open to the possibility that we do not. We do not have any tools at all to determine whether a machine is sentient. So though I don't know all the details of what Lambda has, I'm pretty sure it's not sentient. I'm pretty sure it doesn't really understand what it's saying, I think the deeper question is way more interesting, the philosophical question. But everyone talks about AI progress. What's it going to mean? So let's start with some review. And today's review, I'm going to go back, way back into episode 27. Yes, all the way back to 2008. In episode 27, we talked about big algorithm and the idea, and that was kind of a play off the term big data. And we learned about DARPA's new initiative, which is learning with less labels. And it just means, you know, if you're going to train an AI using machine learning, then you're going to need training data. So you're going to need some examples. Maybe it's some examples of the English language. Maybe it's some examples of photos. You know, something for example that we have is the an algorithm that detects whether an image is an image of a hot dog. That was famously on Silicon Valley, but actually, Foursquare built that, I think, before that came out. On Silicon Valley, we had a hot dog recognizer, and we can recognize hot dogs and hamburgers and milkshakes on all the Foursquare photos. So the idea was you need lots of pictures of hot dogs. You need lots of pictures that are not hot dogs. And DARPA's idea is that they want to be able to train machine learning algorithms with less examples, which is a good thing. That's sort of my bias corrected sampling paper is related to that. And it's just like, let's use less data and try to make the most of what we have. And therefore we use less energy and less cost in order to get the same output. So they feel this will give them an edge and reduce costs. And so, it was one idea that, hey, maybe we could win on data, but maybe we could also win on algorithm. And so I want to come to this paper that came out recently on computational trends, which really kind of takes this idea and puts this together. The paper is called Compute Trends Across Three Eras of Machine Learning. It came out on March 9th of this year, and it has a few authors, not 1,000 authors like some of these Google ones have, but it's 6 authors. So some individual could actually take responsibility for what was written here. First author is Jamie Sevilla, University of Aberdeen, Leonard Haim, Center for the Governance of AI, Anson Ho, University of St. Andrews, Tamay Bezaroglu, MIT. I didn't know I'd be reading these names, so I didn't actually. But now that I've done 4, I have to do the other 2, right? Okay, this is Marius Habhan at the University of Tübingen and Pablo Villalobos of the Computational University of Madrid. So, all right, what is this paper about? What they do in this paper is they identify 3 key areas where machine learning makes progress. So the first area is advances in computational power. It's just like, okay, how powerful are our computers? How powerful are our processors? And that is that's a hardware question. And so even if we did nothing on the software side, even if we just, you know, said, okay, we're going to use this same algorithm, we're going to use this amount of data and this algorithm. Okay, certain algorithms maybe don't improve with computational power. Let's say you just do like a logistic regression, and you have a certain amount of data. You can't increase the amount of data you have. You have this kind of simple linear model. You train it, and the only thing that more computational power can do is it can make sure that you can train in less time. But if it already trains in a reasonable amount of time, then you're not going to get much advance. But a lot of these more complicated algorithms, these more complicated schemes for coming up with a model, these in these situations, the computational power really makes a big difference. Even if you're just doing like a XGBoost, which is like a kind of a famous bread and butter machine learning algorithm that involves like multiple decision trees all kind of averaged together. Well, you could do more and more of those. You get computational power advances, and then you could do even more, and then your algorithm should be even better. So that's one of them, hardware only, and hardware is always improving, which is great. The second one is advances in data size. So that's the big data strategy. That's, I think, the Google strategy, which is just get more and more data to build your models. And the more data you have, the better, the you know, the better your models will be, the more examples it will have seen. So that's one way to improve. And then the third way to improve is algorithm advances. And algorithm advances could be a few things. You might think that these large language models is that Google is building and that OpenAI is building. You might think that those have been made possible by algorithm advances. And I'd say only sort of. I think the big thing that they're doing is they're focusing on data size, tons of data, tons of examples of the English language and questions and answers and, you know, that sort of thing. And then the second one is to throw a lot of computational power at it. And then the algorithm is just kind of a tripped out version of a deep neural net, which we've already had. So you use this kind of great, like good algorithm, but you throw so much data at it and you throw so much computational power at it that you can kind of make the architecture a little bigger. So you can like just say, okay, we have a neural net, but it's a bigger neural net, but it's kind of the same idea. And it's just going to yield a better and better result. And so then next year comes out and we have more powerful computers and we have more data and we can beat what we did last year. And so that's the idea of GPT 2 to GPT 3. And we also talked about this a little bit about the research in, so that the algorithm advances can be a lot more creative. And that's, I think, the point I want to talk about today. We talked about this in research with research in algorithm advances with Andrew Gelman in episode 201, when we talked about statistical insights, where, you know, some of the research into the, you know, like the samplers, the Bayesian samplers, like the no U-turn samplers, that research was identified as a bottleneck. And so they would come up with ways of improving the search of the solution space. And so that is an algorithm advance. Now, you know, you could say that just having a neural net and then building a larger neural net is an algorithm advance. But I would think an algorithm advance would be, you know, changing, you know, top to bottom how the neural net really works, or, you know, coming up with a whole different scheme for how to organize everything. Those are algorithm advances. So note the first two. So the three we have are computational power, data size, and algorithm. So, you know, big computer, big data, and big algorithm. Those are the three. Note that the first two, big computer and big data, that's a function of tremendous scale. So that's an area where a company like Google kind of wins in the area of AI, or large government program, perhaps. Maybe if they had an AI Manhattan project, they would win on these scales. Not that I would want that to happen, but that's what they win. So to compete, I think for a smaller group or an upstart group or a group that wants to, let's say, effect some creative destruction on the AI landscape, I think the strategy there would be to compete on algorithm, a big algorithm or different algorithm, because these large institutions, they're not going to use dumb algorithms, obviously, as they build their things bigger and bigger. They're not just going to continue to do linear regression and some, you know, but they have a very smart kind of neural network architecture, and they're going to hire the best. So it's not like you're going to have your work cut out for you easily, but competing on algorithm, that's the only one where it's possible. First of all, it's possible to do something radically different, like find a niche, where you can't do that in computational power. It's one-dimensional. And also, if you're going to compete on algorithm, it's kind of possible to be creative. And in that sense, it's possible to outwit a bureaucracy like you would find at a large company like Google or even at academia, or certainly in academia or at, you know, in a government program. So this kind of confirms my belief that big algorithm is always changing, and I don't think we've found the master algorithm yet. Pedro Domingo, he's the author of a book called The Master Algorithm, that talks about. We haven't talked about that on the show yet, but we kind of talked about that book kind of talks about all the different approaches to machine learning and how we might one day be able to combine them. I think that thinking about algorithms is where the interesting stuff comes along, whereas some of the more heralded advances of late, of like large language models, are just You know, we're just kind of getting that for free as computers get better and better with Moore's Law. And as, you know, we have more and more data on the internet and that sort of thing, which is not bad. It's not that we don't, not that like, it's not that those are useless, but I feel like all the, it's built on more interesting innovations. And just to get us to that edge was the adding some more machines to it is not that interesting. So algorithms where the interesting stuff happens. And also, in addition to the three areas where machine learning makes progress, this paper also talks about three eras of machine learning. The first is like pre-deep learning, which is kind of funny because I went to grad school in 2010, and you know, I learned from Jan LeCun himself what deep learning is, and they would probably say the deep learning era starts right after that, like 2011, 2012. But it's kind of funny because they put the entire history of AI before, as I was in grad school and before, into one bucket: pre-deep learning. So the three eras are pre-deep learning, deep learning, and large scale. And they're saying today is the large scale. They kind of identify a shift during the middle era, during the deep learning era, which is like the 2010s, and the large scale areas of the 2020s, and the pre-deep learning, let's say, is the 2000s, and you know, 20th century would be the dark ages of AI, I guess, AI winter. So they kind of identify a shift in 2015, you know, in the middle of the deep learning era, as large scale starts to take over, where the compute power required for improvements starts to grow exponentially. So I guess the idea is before that, you can add some more machines. You can, you know, just wait for costs of machines to come down. And great, if you're a researcher, you throw some more compute power at it, and you get some improvements. But now the improvements require the compute power required for improvements has grown exponentially. And you know, until that time, the compute power required an exponential curve as well, but it was similar to Moore's Law. And so I think, just eyeballing the graph here, it's like a factor of 10 every 6 years ago. But recently, that curve has gone super exponential, with a doubling of compute power required for the latest AI going higher and higher. And so this outstrips advances in computation in general. So it's not just that we have more compute power now because, you know, like we're used to, computers just getting better and better and doubling every 18 months or whatever Moore's Law is, but it's that like AI research has been moved forward because these large institutions have been able to pull more and more compute power, and not that they're not just throwing more computation at it, they're throwing a lot more money at it. They're increasing their scale because they think that could get them to the next level. So another way of looking at this is that we kind of went to an 18-month doubling time to double computational power to like a 6-month doubling time, where it's growing a lot faster. And so it just means these companies are, these research wings of largely companies today are competing on building bigger and more expensive systems. So what does that mean? That doesn't really sound very sustainable, does it? You can't just outstrip the power of computational improvements in general, where, you know, that's kind of a research and innovation area. You can't just outstrip that forever and just suck more and more money into your research. So I think there are several possible takeaways here. First of all, compute power now becomes the bottleneck. It's so big and so expensive. So that would mean in the short term, big tech wins, unfortunately, because they have the most of it. But it could also mean that, you know, compute power was the bottleneck, but at some point it's improved so much that there's now low-hanging fruit elsewhere. In other words, everything that you can throw computational power and solve, Google already solved. But then then there are certain things that they can't solve. It just becomes too expensive because of this super exponential curve. And so the interesting research has to go elsewhere, or at least the computational winners will have already won in certain areas. So the interesting research is now in other areas. I hope that makes sense. As a result of what's happened, though, the percent of large-scale AI work coming from academia in particular, has plummeted to almost zero in recent years. It's a very dramatic graph on that. It used to be like 60, 70%. So there's been some reactions to this. Jack Clark on Twitter of Anthropic.ai says that the frontier of knowledge is now accruing to the private sector. Now, normally, me personally, I wouldn't mind that, but we're talking about big tech private sector yet again, concentrated in a small amount of companies. We went over the last week how the culture at Google AI, for example, just seems bizarre and full of power-hungry narcissists. At least that's what how it looks in the media to me. I mean, you know, without being on the inside. And if that's the case, having them control the future of AI for the time being, that doesn't sound like a good idea. That sounds like that would be a problem. Another reaction comes from Gary Marcus, an author on AI issues, who is looking at this trend on big tech, and he says the following. We should all worry about this graph that's showing no more of the research is happening in academia. Academia has its problems, but I have never seen anything like the current AI-ML monoculture, the movement from a peer-reviewed academic culture to a corporate, resource-intensive, hype-driven culture is likely partly responsible. How do we deal with this? I have several ideas. I want to study it more. First, maybe I want to get some of these smart people on my show. Who are the people I mentioned? Jack Clark, Gary Marcus. Maybe I'll reach out to them. Second, I want to kind of disentangle some of the things that he said there. Notice he said hype-driven culture, and I think that's a loaded term. Is the suggestion that academia is not hype-driven? I feel like, you know, I might be able to argue that academia, in fact, is hype-driven. Perhaps we would need to disentangle that, though. Perhaps there's a counter-argument of, well, yes, academia is not hype-driven, but they're not as dumbly following hypes as because they move much slower, they're not following the hype cycle as callously as the good folks in big tech. Maybe that's the suggestion. The word monoculture is interesting as well. What is that monoculture in big tech? That's the same word used by, who's that guy at Google who got fired? Now I want to look this up because I did not intend to write James Damore, right? He's the one who wrote that. What did he do? That was a long time ago, right? I'm pulling this up. He wrote the 3,000 word memo regarding biological differences between the sexes. You all remember this. And people said that his things were harmful, discriminatory, disruptive. He got fired. I think he was also asked to write it, though, and maybe he didn't understand the current environment and didn't know how to tactfully put together his message or have a discussion about it. Maybe the people asked him to write it didn't want to have that discussion. There were problems all around with how that whole thing was handled. But let's just say this. He used the term monoculture, and so I don't think that his description of the monoculture versus some of these AI people's description of the monoculture at Google would be the same description. But it's still an interesting word. I want to kind of pull it apart a little bit more. What is the monoculture at Google? Is there kind of a, do they sort of shepherd everyone into one way of thinking? And I sort of feel like in academia, that there used to be a culture in academia where you have people with vastly different thought processes, although I hear it was like that at Yale when I was there, but I hear now it's maybe not like that anymore, so that's also a problem. But yeah, monoculture is bad, but I want to disentangle what he means by that. Anyway, I thought that tweet was very interesting, though, because even though there's a lot of words there that I want to drill into and find out what they mean. It was a very thought-provoking tweet from Gary Marcus about how he's very concerned about things moving from academic to say Google. How else do we deal with this? Secondly, coming back to our starting topic, Ways to compete with big data on the algorithm side. Very interesting idea. We need to learn how to do that. Remember, the field of artificial intelligence is so vast. And the reason why the field of artificial intelligence is so vast is because the field of intelligence is so vast, because intelligence covers everything. So there has to be many solutions. There are many natural intelligences, humans that have different types of intelligences. One person can be good at in this area. Another person can be good in that area. And it was never winner take all. And there are some animals who are very smart about doing certain things that humans can't do. And so likewise, I think there will be many different artificial intelligences. I disagree with the people who say that it's a winner take all market. Personally, I'm still working on newmap.ai, but it's long-term. I'm actually ready to get some basic feedback on the type system from engineers if you're interested more in that to come. But right now, I'm solving more, metadata issues and versioning issues before I tackle the more, the higher level intelligence issues. But that's kind of the idea, that I'm going back to the base. I really need a good way to describe that, which is what I will do in the coming months. So I look forward to continuing to follow the future of AI on the Local Maximum. Oh, also, wait a minute. There's one more tidbit from Gary Marcus, I think, that I forgot to mention. Let me just pull this up for a second. Right. It's the graph. So the graph shows more specifically that the percent of large-scale AI results in academia plunged from 60% to close to zero in the last 10 years. That's a new trend. And, okay, it's caused by the fact that the large scale this large scale requires industrial strength tech, and only Google can afford it. Okay, good. That's summary. We already talked about this. Yeah, but I'm really looking forward to continuing to following the future of AI on the Local Maximum. So I hope you'll join me, and bear with me for the next few weeks as I come back from travel and start to get my guest roster together again, which I have some really interesting ideas. I have some interesting mathematical ideas I want to talk about. I still want to go over the simplex, which is a fascinating family of shapes on the mathematical side. I was going to go over it today, but I think we're a little out of time. We'll have Aaron back on for a news update, and maybe I'll take some of these talks at Porkfest and I'll make podcast episodes out of them. So looking forward to it. Hope you're enjoying your summer. Have a great week, everyone. That's the show. To support the Local Maximum, sign up for exclusive content and our online community at maximum.locals.com. The Local Maximum is available wherever podcasts are found. If you want to keep up, remember to subscribe on your podcast app. Also, check out the website with show notes and additional materials at localmaxradio.com. If you want to contact me, the host, send an email to localmaxradio@gmail.com. Have a great week. Feel the power.